You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of the 15th of January, 2024. Today we're going to talk about China, but I came across an article by Mike Whitney that then referenced an article by Ron Unz. I'm going to use a foil, a book called Why Nations Fail by Acemoglu and Johnson. It came out in 2012, and believe it or not, won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2024. I read Why Nations Fail when it came out. I have a PDF of it somewhere, and it was very cliche liberal propaganda. It is considered a very important book. The fact that it won, we'll talk more about this here in a minute, but the fact that it won a Nobel Prize years after it was published, meaning that there was time to see if its predictions were going to come true, and they didn't, say quite a bit. It's a cliche rehashing of institutional economics. Institutions are just structures. They're rules and norms that shape and or constrain all kinds of social behavior, economic and otherwise. Some could be very formal, like a legislature. Others informal, like our behavior in a meeting or something. It persists over time. It's not an ad hoc thing, but laws, rules, all kinds of social conventions, these are all either institutions or the results of institutions. Now, because these shape and channel human behavior, socially speaking, they divide it very simply into two types, political and economic. That's a distinction that does them no favor. And it collapses really over the course of the book. And they give very obvious definitions. The distribution of legal power, while the economic regulates property relations among citizens and their productive capacities. More importantly, is that in those two areas, they divide economic or political institutions into either extractive or parasitic on the one side and inclusive on the other. Again, these are very broad, very abstract, and again, that level of abstraction doesn't do them any favors. Inclusive economic institutions protect property rights. This is basically liberal capitalism. Property is not simply a possession of a tiny elite. There's due process. They don't allow the alienation of private property without it. Workers in a proper inclusive system have an interest in increasing productivity since their gains will accrue at least partly to them. And of course, they have to have similar political institutions, broad participation in governing, so implying that policies will then benefit the majority of people. And the level of assumptions and vagueness in all of this, it makes it very difficult to argue with, but given we know where they're going here, it becomes much easier. So extractive institutions exclude quite a number of people from participation in the rewards of work, although it's very unclear what aspect or what part of the laboring classes this applies to. There's a tiny group of oligarchs and there's everyone else. And they use cliched examples like slavery, serfdom, or any other form of bonded labor. And they're, again, cliché definitions and mental images. Apparently, these people have never left their university offices because we live in a system of an oligarchy based on rents. Classic example of an extractive parasitic institution, especially in a financialized economy. But they don't notice that. Extractive institutions are what other people have. Workers, of course, have no incentive under such a system to increase productivity, since almost all additional value will accrue to others. The examples that they use are hackneyed, and they amount to media descriptions of international bad guys. Extractive, essentially, is how the media will describe systems, either political or economic or both, that the regime doesn't like. The U.S., of course, is inclusive. Because they're abstract, they can apply to anybody the author chooses, and they're useless. However, it's part of the comforting myth that Americans, especially elite Americans, have to believe, have to continue telling themselves. And that's where China comes in. Essentially, what they're saying here is procedural justice. Inclusive institutions, they're not dealing with actual outcomes. Procedural justice refers to the fact that if certain procedures, like presenting one's defense in court, if that's guaranteed, procedures similar to that, or Miranda rights, if all of that is followed, then the result must be proper. So for them, American elections are fair by definition. The enemies of liberalism are inherently illegitimate. And these assumptions are so ingrained in academia that they exist unnoticed. And the only alternative offered, back when I was in grad school as well as now, is some leftist variation, some semi-Marxism. They rest on caricatures. The caricatures that the regime has painted for different systems and the labels used to describe them. Liberalism today, or inclusivity, as they would say, it implies, and in fact it rests upon, the belief that major media stories are accurate. And the same thing goes for official statistics, public perception, and academic research, that they are not loaded with ideological assumptions. But they've already equated corruption with extractive, and extractive with authoritarianism. Of course, their theory is circular. And it's no shock to anybody that in 2024, years after this was released, they win the Nobel Prize. One of the reasons that they came up with this thesis of extractive versus inclusive is because they, among other things, compare American institutional life to the Chinese, and it justifies and encourages current American policy. Ron Unz makes the point, and I would have said the same thing, it's not an accident that this book was released a few years after the 2008-2009 financial meltdown. But in addition to that, billions in bailouts, the very definition of extractive, an extractive elite, and this elite apparently is invisible to the authors as well as those on the Nobel Committee. For them, American neoliberalism is their archetypes of inclusive institutional life. And because they only deal with procedures, actual results don't matter. If the procedures are there, then the result is just. Now, there's plenty of areas other than China that disprove this nonsense. In fact, I've spent years explaining in great detail how systems that they would call authoritarian are far superior in terms of economic growth and development and general fairness and justice. I reject the theory of procedural justice. But in his review, Unz says this, and it's a great line, or a great quote. The rise of China truly ranks among the most important world developments of the last 100 years, with America still trapped in its fifth year at the time of his writing of economic hardship, and the Chinese economy poised to surpass our own before the end of this decade. China looms very large on the horizon. We are living in the early years of what journalists once dubbed the Pacific Century, yet there are worrisome signs that it may be the Chinese Century. But does the Chinese giant have feet of clay? In this book, Why Nations Fail, the economists Darren Acemoglu and James Robertson characterize China's ruling elites as extractive, parasitic, and corrupt, and predict that Chinese economic growth will soon falter and decline, while America's inclusive institutions have taken us from strength to strength. They argue that a country governed as a one-party state, without the free media, or checks and balances of our own democratic system, cannot long prosper in the modern world. And this is why I say that this rests on authority. It rests on the idea that the ideological assumptions of the media and academia are correct and true. But procedures don't mean much. Results mean much. Results, in fact, mean everything here. We all know the statistics in one form or another. After Mao's death in 1976 and the reconsolidation of the party in 1978-79, China engaged in the most rapid and sustained rate of economic growth in the history of the universe. Between 1978 and the early 2010s, the economy grew by 40 times. 1980, America's economy was something like 15 times larger than China's. But of course, given this metric that you're talking about, it's clear today that China has surpassed America's total economic output. And the majority of China's newly created wealth has flowed, as he says, to ordinary Chinese workers. China has gone from a third world, a fourth world basket case, to a first world country in a generation. I've said the same, Korea or Taiwan under military rule. But at the same time, American incomes have been falling for decades. Chinese incomes are doubling roughly every 8 years. Just over the last 10 years, 8 to 10 years, the real wages, that is all things being equal, of Chinese workers went up 150%. This is why the regime is constantly harping on this idea, hoping that it's going to come true. I've pointed this out 100 times, that every week or so, maybe every 2 weeks, there's an article in a major newspaper that says that either the Russian or the Chinese economy is going to collapse. It's so constant. I even one time offered a list of these. And that's what these authors have to claim. Now remember, this came out in 2012. None of their predictions came true, and yet they won the 2024 Nobel Prize in Economics. And is it possible that precisely because this justification for American political institutions did not pan out, that it won the award? The very fact that this book doesn't, when they talk about contemporary events, they don't use statistics very much. Facts aren't important. Procedures and the ideological abstractions, terms like inclusive that you can really define any way you want. American workers, especially white male American workers, have seen their incomes collapse. Inflation has chipped away at whatever remains. Chinese workers have seen, just since 2000, a real income increase of over 1,000%. Yet the thesis in why nations fail, it's just a rehash of neoliberalism, liberal democratic capitalism, and justifying it, just using different language. But the fact that this book is taken seriously, and for them to continue to claim that the ruling elite in China is extractive, but the American is not, well, it goes back to what I've been saying for years. This is projection. This is a psychological condition. Because Western elite fit the definition of extractive perfectly. But this has no effect on the nature of this and similar theories. In fact, it was Francis Fukuyama, of all people, who initially said, and he criticized this book, he initially said that the theory doesn't apply to the Chinese. I don't know why he stopped at China, because there's a million other places. And their response was typical of them. Well, maybe there's some vague level of inclusiveness here. But this is, more than 10 years ago, predicted that it will not reach the same levels of per capita income as Portugal, ever, because of China's extractive institutions. Well, during the last 30 years, real per capita income in China has grown by more than 1,400%. In 1990, China's per capita income was maybe $1,000, and today it's almost $30,000. The authors then have to assume that this tremendous growth over this long period of time will just stop. But they don't explain how. The per capita national income is really, it's a rough way to put this. Portugal is also deeply in debt and has an extremely high unemployment rate, very high youth unemployment rate, and China has neither. So these claims are a bit more of a misdirection. But by the time China surpasses all of this, this prediction will be long forgotten. But let me use another example. Homeownership. Chinese homeownership rates are superior to the American version. 90% of Chinese own their homes. In the U.S., it's way below. It's falling from 75% recently and going down, especially after 2008. More significantly, only a few Chinese have mortgages, 10% or fewer, which is remarkable. But the opposite is true. In the U.S., rents have gone through the roof, and almost all homeowners, are massively in debt. Things like per capita income, while they're good macro indicators, has nothing to do with stuff like this. Wages, quality of life, standard of living. Poverty is going up in the Western world for a whole bunch of reasons. And I think these numbers are understated. Homelessness, too. The cost of living in China is much lower. In fact, Mike Whitney reproduced a screenshot. I think one was, for basic staples that people need in the household. One from a Chinese retailer and another from an American retailer. And compared the prices. There is no comparison. It's very expensive to be an American. And all of this is happening at the same time you have this massive concentration of wealth in this very small overclass, disproportionately Jewish overclass. You're not shocked to know that maybe the top 1% hold at least as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And that's an accelerating trend. There was no recovery after 2009. And even if there was, it didn't benefit anyone because 90% of that value was expropriated by the top 1% anyway. And 37% of that captured by the wealthiest 0.01%, which Unz tells us is about 15,000 households. Oh, I think that was Whitney who said that. Another problem China does not have. Shipbuilding is another very important indicator. That's not something vague because it's necessary for naval dominance. All new merchant ship orders, 65% of them are being handled by China. U.S., it's 0.13%. New merchant ship orders from China have increased by 170%, which is totally unprecedented. Ship construction in China is 232 times greater than that of the U.S., and this is all in the space of 20 years. China's ship construction capacity yearly is 33 million tons. The U.S., 100,000 tons. In other words, there is no real American shipbuilding industry, meaning that she's dependent on others. Her naval military dominance is partly based on her massive industrial capacity. And the Chinese build everything at home. Yes, the state subsidizes some of these industries, which is why they're so successful, but they have granted China leadership in these fields. In other words, the whole thesis of why nations fail is that this is not supposed to be happening. China is not supposed to be an inclusive system, and yet the results are extraordinary for everybody, not just an elite. So American workers have experienced zero gains. I mean, young women certainly have. But everything from globalization to immigration, white workers have seen zero economic gains. So either the theory is entirely false, and that would imply that these academics are so sheltered that they don't know how ordinary people live. Let me quote him again here. The ideas presented in Why Nations Fail seem both true and false. They claim that harmful political institutions and corrupt elites can inflict huge economic damage upon a society seems correct. But while the authors turn a harsh eye towards elite misbehavior across time and space, from ancient Rome to Tsarist Russia to rising China, of course, their vision seems to turn rosy-tinted when they consider present-day America. The society in which they themselves live, and whose ruling elites lavishly fund the academic institutions with which they are affiliated. Given the American realities of the last dozen years, it's quite remarkable that the scholars who wrote a book entitled Why Nations Fail never glanced outside of their own office windows. Listeners and readers of mine know that I've been saying this in a million different ways for 30 years. Again, these men won the Nobel Prize for manifestly false theories, manifest by their predictions that didn't come true. There has to be a deeper cause for the accolades they received. Again, published in 2012, nothing that they have claimed has come true. All their predictions are not just false, but absurdly false. I knew at the time this was just projection, a coping mechanism and a defense mechanism, rather than analysis. And yet these theories remain dominant among those who the regime calls experts, regardless how incorrect they've been, over and over again. Now, one of the reasons I say that China is physically has a much larger economy than the U.S. is because they're actually industrialized. The U.S. is not. The metric is, and goes by different names, but it's real production, the real productive economy. What economy actually is, producing things. That is three times larger than the U.S. And growing far more rapidly. Real production refers to the actual creation of things, not services and not the manipulation of debt. The U.S. is not an industrialized country. It's not a superpower. In fact, China, in that, using that metric, far outweighs not just the U.S., but the entire Western world. The only reason that this book could be published and accepted is because it allows a certain psychological comfort. Another way that they deal with the Chinese model is that, well, they say, well, this is just because they copy, have stolen Western economic innovations. If you recall, they said the exact same things about the Japanese in the 1980s. That means, or that implies, that the Chinese cannot innovate. Well, the belief is false. Again, but regardless of its falsity, it remains because it does what a myth is supposed to do. It helps soothe the psyche. A psyche in America that can't cognize the fact that she is no longer a superpower. Yes, China leads the world in major technologies, energy production, electric vehicles, quantum computing, whatever the hell that is. Of course, the theory collapses. Facts don't matter. A guy by the name of Bertrand wrote in, of all places, The Economist in 2024. I want to quote him here. This is very much against their interest. That's why it's important. And he's talking about the thesis of this book relative to China. You don't become first in science with a population of slaves, but with an extremely highly educated population, many of whom were educated in the U.S. and voluntarily went back to China, which in and of itself destroys the slave narrative, who was empowered to think outside the box and make bold bets. Thinking like this is all about giving yourself all too convenient excuses to stop competing because you lie to yourself about the competition not being fair. It's not. You're just not as good. The moment you start acknowledging this is the moment that you'll start actually pulling yourself together. Until then, China thanks you very much for lying to yourself. So, The Economist of London, the mouthpiece for the Rothschilds, and it's rare that they have signed articles, by the way, they make it a point to say that this is nonsense. The book that won the Nobel Prize years after it was released, not any aspect of it is true. This economic establishment has sheltered its illusions with this propaganda and censorship bubble. Their world is a sanitized one. As I've said 100 times, I'll say it 100 times again, academics and journalists today don't have access to ideas and sources of information because of the nature of this censorship, especially on campus. Yes, it's true that media censorship becomes more intense when the regime is declining. We talked about this with the USSR in its last years, hiding embarrassing facts, which, of course, perfectly fits the U.S. in 2025. No public intellectual, say in the 1980s, or their successors ever predicted any of this. They have not recognized any of this, suggesting that their entire intellectual foundation is false. So they continue to have to lie and say that Chinese growth either isn't real or it's going to collapse because it's not neoliberal. The institutions aren't inclusive. When you have a strong state, when you have a strong national, and I dare say even racial state in certain areas, according to this book, it can't be the cause of prosperity or growth. On the other hand, you have to say that the financialized American and hence Jewish economy must be successful by definition, regardless of high unemployment and non-existent growth. Even if you use official statistics, facts aren't important. China possesses the wrong institutions, at least in their cliched view of the world, and therefore any good things that you see have to be explained away. Chinese education, the way it educates, it's, and you see this amongst Chinese all over the world, which have been, they've been very successful no matter where they go. One talks about the ancient examination regime that created its bureaucracy and intellectuals. You know, it waxed and waned over the centuries. But really today, nothing has changed. I mean, Mao was this, you know, massive disruption, but there's a huge cultural emphasis on education and academic achievement. Americans seem very uncomfortable with this. In fact, they make fun of it, the Tiger Mom idea. Well, that's how their parents were. Well, that's how their great-grandparents were. They just don't recognize it. Parental involvement in the day-to-day life of their students in Chinese schools. Very important. This is worldwide. Chinese education system places a huge emphasis on, of course, mathematics and science, and these are huge priorities. They still have this very high-stakes exam system that is tremendously motivating. They don't have participation trophies. But this is ancient. This isn't anything new. Even things like rote memorization and repetitive practice, yes, it does have positive outcomes. Teachers in China have high expectations, huge work ethic. And of course, at the same time, the Chinese government has directed tremendous investments in Chinese education, especially in urban areas and especially in non-Han areas. Certainly, urban Chinese students have far greater access to things than the destroyed inner cities of the U.S. and Britain. The U.S. doesn't really have the resources, human or otherwise, to imitate a system like this. Living standards continue to fall. Deindustrialization, stagnant wages, a parasitic and extractive elite, absurd spending, tremendous waste, chronic inflation. The middle class, to the extent that it exists entirely on debt. Not really, as does the country as a whole. To put it crudely, Americans are too fat and self-satisfying to do much about their condition. You know, as of recent, I think it was last year, the UN published in their Industrial Development Organization's sector, predicted by that 2030, China's share of the world's industrial production will reach almost half. In other words, half of all the industrial production in the world is going to be Chinese. The U.S. stands right now at 11. In 2000, China's share was 6%. So the thesis of something like why nations fail is so absurd to the point where there has to be another explanation. And this self-justifying it's easy to find comfort in abstractions rather than facts, because facts have a tough time getting out of the way. The U.S. is the ultimate, or the regime as a whole, is extractive. They are not productive. An oligarchy is a tightly controlled economic world. And the way that the U.S. treats its adversaries, which is usually a creation of their own mind, with sanctions, quotas, tariffs, Trump's recent threat, Trump's administration is off to a disastrous start before it even started. Just more proof that the U.S. is an oligarchy. There is no even a pretense to free markets anymore. You have people who still think that China is third world. The truth is that China's total economic size in 2000 was 12% of the U.S. You can't explain this away, and today, of course, it's larger and far more stable. The response in books like this, the regime projects its own troubles and inadequacies onto an easily caricatured Chinese or Russian other. Even saying that China's GDP will surpass the U.S. around 2035, that's a coping mechanism. It's not a reality. In real terms, it's long surpassed the United States, especially in very important industries. Because the U.S. is so radically financialized and hence extractive, that itself has altered how things like economic growth is measured and understood. We know how the Bureau of Labor Statistics has manipulated to the point where they've lost many employees. They're constantly changing the metric of things like unemployment, hiding the real numbers, excluding arbitrarily certain things to make the number look better. The truth is that profits from speculation and debt are not economic, nor are they growth, but they're included as such in official statistics. That's the very definition of extractive. They're rents. That's the entire Wall Street idea. Where does this value come from? Stock price. No, it comes from labor. And the financialization and Judaization of the economy has led to this proliferation of very complex, debt leveraging ideas and scams. We've talked about it on this show many times. The only thing it's done is enriched a handful of parasites while diverting untold trillions to unproductive activities. But over the last 40 years, the U.S. has become basically deindustrialized. It's American firms who go off to China, taking advantage of both low-wage and educated labor, although that's changing because the wages are going way up in China. Sometimes even Chinese manufacturers are going to Vietnam, which of course does nothing but render the U.S. dependent on others, especially China. Yes, that's rational for the oligarchs in the short term, but it's destroying the American economy, and the regime is well aware. So what's the last option? What happens even when books like that we're talking about today, Why Nations Fail, when that doesn't even do it anymore, when the lies don't work anymore? A bloody war. This is the purpose of the war in Ukraine and the endless provocations against China that I've been detailing for you for God knows how long. The U.S. can't win a direct head-to-head war with either power, but winning isn't the point. The point is to put a dent, maybe a big dent, in China's economic life and economic growth, and it doesn't matter what has to be sacrificed. Books like this are part of a pseudo-intellectual demonization of foreign systems, foreign leaders. Again, Johnson's Law is so important here. Everything that these guys are talking about depends on it. But this demonization, I don't care whether you use words like extractive, I don't care if you lie, whatever the method is, but this demonization is always the first step towards war. We all know that the ignorant and controlled Western media created these cartoon caricatures of people like, Gaddafi and Putin. Again, depending on widespread ignorance in order to function. Dozens of times, the process is exactly the same. They just fill in the blanks. But academics, pseudo-experts, they still can't see a pattern. Endless provocations. You know, these planes going into or very close to hostile airspace. Of course, provoking a response and then claiming that this response is an act of war. This happens every few weeks. The sanctions, the mindless slander. Americans are exhausted, extremely unhealthy, and hence very easy to hypnotize into yet another bloody conflict that doesn't benefit them whatsoever. Donald Trump is talking about a war on China, even if he's only talking about in the economic and trade sense. I think it's something that the press loves this kind of rhetoric, has blown way out of proportion. Even 5 years ago, the number of foreign companies registered in mainland China was over a million from the Ministry of Commerce. $2 trillion, I think, American dollars have been invested over there. 60% of China's, and I use that in quotes, exports to the U.S. are from American or Western companies who keep the price the same. But of course, their labor costs compliance costs are much lower. So I'm not sure what tariffs on Chinese trade is going to do. The semiconductor industry, as well as the value of the currency. Well, China has a state-run central bank. So the regime is very frustrated. It can't control the value of the yuan. They've always claimed that China undervalues the currency, meaning that their imports to the U.S. are cheaper. Well, for actual Chinese companies exporting to the U.S., their profit margins are pretty small. That doesn't mean the Chinese will give in to any of this. There's a mutual dependency, but the U.S. needs China far more than China needs the U.S. American companies, in huge numbers, have deindustrialized America, moved to places like China. Then they make money off the same people they just laid off in order to dominate the market. Western companies, not quote-unquote China. What kind of sanctions can you possibly have here? Or Carolyn Bartholomew, who is a dummy. She wrote in The American Prospect in 2009. It's a terrible article, but she does have one good point here. I can't remember where I saw this, but she says, China policy has, over the last two decades, been driven by the interests of the multinational corporations. And those global firms have benefited from many of China's policies. Starting several decades ago, it was a handful of the exporting elite, Boeing, Motorola, GE among them, who argued persuasively to the Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations that the U.S. economic interests would be served if only these companies had access to the Chinese consumer. Today, of course, we see the result of that kind of thinking. With the global economic crisis, American workers have ended up without jobs and without pension funds. At the behest of American multinationals, Washington has championed the cause of corporate interests masquerading as free trade. By the way, in this article, she actually used the phrase, without irony, Leninist capitalism. Of course, what she's talking about isn't free trade. It's foreign trade under the conditions of oligarchy. And I doubt that she ever rejected the arguments from Boeing, Motorola, and GE years ago. She's on a bandwagon here. Still, blaming China as some abstraction for the actions of American oligarchs, this very same extractive elite that these authors can't seem to see, is just yet again typical globalist manipulation. The drive to war, whether trade or physical, is ultimately not driven necessarily by worries over comparative growth. But you have a national socialist, Chinese government, resisting the imperial arrogance of foreign oligarchs, that is, the regime, especially in Washington and New York. Billionaire elites want to control Chinese politics directly. They're kind of used to doing stuff like that. But a country as large as China or India, they don't like being ordered around. So instead, they finance terror groups in Western China, rioters in Hong Kong, or separatists in Taiwan. Late last year, there was Pakistani, Babani Nayak. A very good piece. Let me quote him directly here. American imperialism and its European allies have failed to acknowledge the failures of their capitalist models of development, which has led to a declining ability to meet their consumption needs through domestic production. Capitalism, driven by the pursuit of profit and mass consumerism, has undermined domestic industries, contributing to the deindustrialization of both Europe and America. The trade deficit is a direct result of this imbalance between production and consumption. In contrast, China's trade surplus is driven by its technologically advanced workforce, which produces more than it consumes. As a result, China exports more and imports less, leading to this same trade surplus. Meanwhile, capitalist countries like the US and those in Western Europe consume more than they produce, which causes their imports to exceed exports, and that results in trade deficits. In this context, imperialist nations are engaged in an economic war with China over this very trade surplus. The imperialist powers are deflecting attention from their own capitalist failures by unjustly blaming China. Now, despite the kind of the leftist rhetoric here, he's absolutely correct. Any objective outsider can see that the book we're talking about here is completely ridiculous. And you could do this on many different levels. There's nothing inclusive about American political or economic institutions. Not whatsoever. And it really doesn't matter their abstractions as it applies to China. They're certainly no experts on that. But China has become a superpower, which is very tough for Americans to deal with. The party rejected both capitalism and Maoism. They have raised almost 800 million people out of poverty and creating this massive infrastructure project like the Belt and Road. Washington is not able to answer any of that. Washington doesn't really have an answer for anything. It doesn't have a future vision like the Chinese do. If you remember that stupid infrastructure bill that we're talking about, that had no relation to infrastructure. The anti-inflation bill had nothing to do with inflation. It's simply labels. What Washington offers is more projection, debt, sanctions, color revolutions, endless war. And yet Donald Trump is saying, and he's got it into his head. This was actually back in November. He got it into his head that the BRICS group is going to create their own currency to replace the dollar. But they've never said anything like that. But what he said, I think this is on Truth Social. He said, we require a commitment from those countries that they will neither create a new BRICS currency nor back any other currency to replace the mighty U.S. dollar. Or they will face 100% tariffs and should expect to say goodbye to selling into the wonderful U.S. economy. This kind of, it's bombastic and everything. It's a stylistic thing. But these are empty, sterile threats. The G7 is collapsing. And so they project that onto Russia and China, even though there is no sign of it. The fact that their sanctions have failed, not only failed miserably, but have actually assisted in the consolidation of new trading routes and new trading partnerships, is something, again, they have a tough time cognizing. And now that BRICS has new members, Iran, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, Ethiopia, they seem to be able to bring anybody in, I guess. Now it's like almost half the world's population. Whether it be GDP, population, or high tech, BRICS has surpassed the G7. The only thing that the U.S. has is essentially its global Jewish media, porn, and the dollar, which has long since been undermined. Now, of course, BRICS has never said they want to replace the dollar. I don't know where he got that from. But certainly, they're de-dollarizing, and there's nothing the U.S. can do about it. People who control Joe Biden are making all these, the very same claims. New sanctions now. I don't know how there's anything left to sanction. Keep in mind, though, that sanctions have to be directed against specific people or institutions. De-dollarization is a fact. There's nothing that the U.S. can do about it. But the bottom line, no matter what myths or ideological theories you may adhere to, the Western oligarchic system is a miserable, tyrannical failure. It functions by censorship and public ignorance. The bottom line is that the regime sees China and the Russo-Chinese alliance even more so as a threat that has to be countered by any means up to and including open war. So the U.S. is threatening China, whether it be Taiwan, South China Sea, it doesn't matter. The coverage of the press is extremely negative. While, Meng Wanzhou was arrested a couple of years ago at the Vancouver airport, the anti-China coalition in the Asia-Pacific, the microchip sanctions, and on and on and on. That's just a first step. But books that are manifestly false, manifestly absurd, getting the Nobel Prize, that suggests that there is a deep psychological reason for these kind of theories, for these kind of ideas to continue to have any kind of currency, and for these men to have any kind of reputation anymore, despite everything they say, every prediction being false. They still get the Nobel Prize. That has to be explained, and I think I've done that. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.